Good morning. This is Neil Strausser with the CBS World News Roundup. They are still counting the dead from Tuesday's tornadoes along the Texas-Oklahoma border. Yesterday, 48 more tornadoes were counted in the lower and middle Mississippi Valley, and one more death has been reported. And today, the same area is again endangered by a violent weather system. That area described by Walter Copes of the U.S. Weather Service Severe Storm Forecast Center in Kansas City.
If you drew a line from along the Mississippi River to southern Illinois and then went from there up the Illinois-Indiana border, you would have the center of the danger area. Now that would reach from there to the west into western Arkansas, northeastern Missouri, and to the east of that line into eastern Kentucky, Tennessee. The high threat area means that there will be thunderstorms throughout the area. Some of the thunderstorms will be producing high winds and large hail and some tornadoes.
Most of the tornadoes yesterday spared populated areas, but those Tuesday killed at least 60 people in Wichita Falls, Texas, and other cities on both sides of the border with Oklahoma. And among the living, there are many homeless, and David Dick looked into their situation.
The First Baptist Church is one of five disaster centers in Wichita Falls, a place where some of the homeless curled up on old pew cushions last night on the floor of the church auditorium, a place where hot meals are available, and last night's spiritual nourishment at the regular midweek prayer services led by the Reverend Morris Chapman.
There are those of you here who've lost your home. Many of us here who did not have our homes demolished, and yet we've been assisting with our friends today, trying to show our love and care and concern, for it is a time that we can be supportive and loving. We are in that state of shock in our city. The days will come when we'll have the emotional release and the full reality of what has occurred will be facing us.
There was a silent prayer for all the victims of the tornadoes which struck the Red River Valley. David Dick, CBS News.
A clipper ship, the Pride of Baltimore, is 3 days late arriving in Norfolk, Virginia, after encountering heavy seas and high winds off North Carolina. The vessel carries a crew of 11. The Coast Guard has begun to search the area, but its owners say it's not unusual for a sailing vessel to encounter such delays. Federal officials at the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant say they may begin the process of finally shutting down the crippled plant this weekend if engineers find gas levels in the reactor's cooling water are low enough. Meanwhile, in Washington, the government moves today to try to make sure there are no more Three Mile Island accidents. Robert Shackney has more.
Government regulators later today will be issuing new safety instructions and procedures for 42 licensed atomic power reactors similar in design to Three Mile Island. And according to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, there are no plans to shut any of these reactors down. Yesterday, the commission made public a finding that in 23 of the 25 reactors built by Westinghouse, safety cooling water systems might fail to turn on automatically when needed, and that the problem might extend to all reactors of the pressurized water type. The cause apparently would be faulty readings from a water level indicator, the same kind of faulty reading that proved so damaging at Three Mile Island. In a series of meetings with regulatory experts yesterday, Westinghouse and other manufacturers said different procedures and new instructions to control room technicians could take care of any problem. And the commission said it would require appropriate short-term corrective actions. But a commission spokesman said that the regulatory staff does not now plan to recommend any reactor shutdown. Robert Shackney, CBS News, Washington.
President Carter, who yesterday named an 11-member commission to make a longer-term study of the accident, left Washington today on his Easter vacation. He plans a 10-day stay on Sapelo Island off the coast of Georgia, a new vacation spot, as Leslie Stahl notes.
The president used to vacation on nearby St. Simon's Island in a home owned by his friend, businessman Smith Bagley. But Bagley has been indicted on charges of conspiring to inflate the prices of his company's stock and to defraud participants in the company's pension plan. And so the Carters have changed islands. According to spokesman Jody Powell, the home they will stay in on Sapelo Island is, quote, a Georgia State University facility. The White House refused to allow newsmen on Sapelo Island earlier this week to take pictures of the facility. But it is known that the president will have many opportunities to jog, fish, play tennis, lie on the beach, and avoid the White House press corps. Reporters are staying on another island and being told the president's vacation house is totally inaccessible to them, either by land, sea, or air. Leslie Stahl, CBS News, the White House.
In his first detailed interview since entering the alcoholic treatment program at Long Beach Naval Hospital, the president's brother, Billy Carter, has told the New York Times that not a dime of loans made to the Carter warehouse was diverted to the Carter presidential campaign. Billy Carter also said there might have been some slight delays in notifying the National Bank of Georgia about collateral movements, but the warehouse was never behind in its loan payments. A federal investigation of the loan operation is still underway. While 100,000 Christians and Jews gather in the Holy Land for Passover and Easter, President Sadat of Egypt has started out on a pilgrimage of his own today in the cause of peace in the Middle East. Doug Sager reports from Cairo.
Anwar Sadat left Cairo today for a barnstorming tour through Upper Egypt. Like the nationwide referendum a week from today, Sadat's four-day trip to some of Egypt's most isolated countryside is billed here as a chance for the masses to visibly demonstrate their support for the treaty with Israel. It is also a flamboyant opening to what is officially termed here the democratic dialogue. Sadat himself enjoys these journeys into the heartland, and in the past year they have become increasingly frequent. Sadat meets with local leaders and tours development projects, often walking through cow barns and studiously inspecting cement works. Land reclamation and becoming self-sufficient in food are pet projects with Sadat. He says they have a higher priority than negotiations with Israel. And now that the treaty has been signed, sources here say Sadat will be spending even more of his time in the field. Doug Sager for CBS News, Cairo.
The execution toll climbs in Iran, and David Miller in Tehran reports the firing squads may not be through yet.
Eight more members of the former regime of the Shah have been executed in five different cities in Iran. Most were described as representatives of the Savak, the Shah's secret police, and accused of torture and murder. Other details were not available, but their deaths were announced either on Tehran radio or in the local press without elaboration. It was also made known that the former commander of counterintelligence in the Iranian Air Force is on trial, accused of cooperating with the CIA. He was reported to have confessed that he acted as a go-between for American and Iranian officials. What his fate is likely to be is unknown, but almost all trials since the revolution have ended in convictions and quick punishment. David Miller, CBS News, Tehran.
Extensive looting is reported sweeping Kampala today, to the dismay of Tanzanian forces who captured Uganda's capital, but have been too busy mopping up pockets of resistance to keep order. The main event planned for the Soviet celebration today of the 18th anniversary of the launching of the first man, a Russian, into space, did not come off. Soyuz 33, with a Russian commander and the first Bulgarian in space as its co-pilot, failed to link up with the two cosmonauts orbiting in the Salyut 6 space station. The news agency TASS blamed deviations in the approach equipment and said the Soyuz craft will return to Earth. Despite the tentative settlement between the Teamsters and the truckers, the Ford Motor Company announced last night that it will continue short shift operations the rest of this week and will suspend some passenger car production next week. From Detroit, Bob Fall reports a slow recovery ahead for the auto industry.
Though the strike is over and the lockout has ended, very little has changed for the auto industry. Detroit still doesn't have all the parts it needs. The supply pipeline is still dry and it will take several days to get it filled again. That, coupled with the upcoming holiday, means full production won't resume here until Tuesday at the earliest. So for the rest of this week, production at Ford, General Motors, and Chrysler will be cut back. About 100,000 assembly line workers will continue to be laid off, and thousands more will work shortened hours. Analysts figure the Teamster dispute will cost the industry an estimated $800 million in lost production and sales. Automakers can make up most of that, but only by paying out so much in overtime that operating costs will be driven up and earnings will be slashed. Still, for an industry which feared a virtual shutdown, the worst is over, even though no one here is certain when all the trucks will be rolling and when inventories will be fully replenished. Bob Fall, CBS News, Detroit.
After 5 years of hard bargaining in Geneva, the United States and the world's other leading industrial countries have agreed on a trade liberalization policy, reducing and in some cases eliminating barriers to free trade. But there is concern among the negotiators about acceptance by the U.S. Congress.